Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore. I'd like to thank you for supporting your local independent booksellers. Tonight, I am pleased to introduce Ali Sethi as he presents and signs his debut novel, The Wishmaker. He was born in Lahore, Pakistan. Growing up, his father was involved in book sales, and later his parents started their own newspaper. He attended Harvard College and lived in New York for a while before returning back to Lahore. He has contributed work to The New Yorker, The Nation, amongst other publications. Much of the advanced praise for The Wishmaker focuses on the insight into Pakistan that it gives us, a view of a part of the world that is becoming more pertinent to our lives here in the U.S. every day. Though this window is important and appreciated, what gives this book its real power is its deeper message. This is a story of coming of age and pursuing one's dreams to find happiness and identity, a tale of sacrifice, betrayal, and friendship. Please join me in a warm welcome for this promising young author, Ali Sethi.
Thank you all for coming here, and thank you for that introduction. So I'll propose a kind of format for the thing today, and you can improve it with your suggestions. I could read a little bit from the book and tell you something about it, and then we can do a Q&A, or we can hang out, or we can chat, whatever you like. But I think I'll read a little bit from it first, and before that, tell you a little bit about the book and about the story. So, The Wishmaker is a novel. It's a story set in mostly in 1990s Pakistan, which is when I was growing up there, in a city called Lahore. Lahore is my hometown. It's a city of about, now it's a city of about 7 million people. It is very close to the Indian border, Pakistan's border with India. So it's in the northeast of Pakistan. And it's also the cultural capital of Pakistan, and has been a cultural capital of North India for about 600 years now. So it's a city that's quite rich and has many layers of history, and its rulers have tried again and again to come up with new layers of identity for the city itself. So that is also, in a way, a framing story for this book. It's set almost entirely in Lahore. Most of it is set in the 1990s, but there are parts of it that are set in the 80s in Lahore, when Pakistan was being ruled by a gang of generals, and was we had 10 years of what was called Islamization. The military government tried to Islamize society. And really much of what you're seeing today in Pakistan, and what we in Pakistan are experiencing, the militancy and the suicide bombings and the shootings and assassinations, is the ripening of that process. The setting up of madrasas in the rural parts of Pakistan, especially in all the places where the government failed to provide education and failed to provide an infrastructure and healthcare. With those madrasas were set up with mostly Saudi Arabian funding, but often with indirectly with American funding as well in the 80s, when the Soviets were being fought in Afghanistan by the generals in Pakistan. So it was a very toxic time, and some of this story is set in the 1980s at that time, and then parts of it are set in the 1940s, when Pakistan was created, and Lahore, the city, witnessed the worst violence at that time, because it was the city that got carved up. It was the center of the Punjab province, which was divided, and overnight people were told that Hindus and Sikhs would have to go to India and Muslims would come to Pakistan. So even if a place had like a 49% non-Muslim population, it fell into Pakistan. So it was a very turbulent time. Anyway, the bulk of the story, as I say, is set in the 1990s, and it's set in middle-class urban Pakistan, and it's about these two children. It's told mostly through the perspective of these two kids, a boy and a girl. The boy's name is Zaki and the girl's name is Samar, and they are cousins, but not exactly. Samar is Zaki's paternal grandmother's younger sister's daughter. So she's sort of actually his aunt. But because she's only 4 years older than him, they have an informal and a friendly relationship. And they're growing up together in the same house. Samar's mother and father live in the village. And there's this divide, urban-rural divide, which I understand it exists in America as well, actually, this idea that people who live in the cities are suspect always for people who live in the villages or live in more rural settings and think that those lifestyles and those ideas are not for the village people who are hardworking and, you know, and old-fashioned in many ways. And so, you know, in a place like Pakistan, those distinctions are exacerbated. They're much more pronounced. So Samar, while she has a rural background, is growing up in the city without her parents. She's growing up with her aunt, who is Zaki's grandmother and who runs the household, and is also growing up with Zaki's mother, Zaki's widowed mother, who is a journalist and thinks of herself as a feminist. And the male figure in the house is missing because Zaki's father, who was a flying officer in the Pakistan Air Force, died in a plane crash. And so in a mostly male-dominated environment, this is something of an unusual setting. It's not impossible, it's not implausible. I know many people who have been raised in households that have been run often entirely by women, but it's this boy grows up feeling it as something of a deprivation because it sets him apart from everybody else. And as he grows older, he comes to realize that it's actually a great advantage to him because he ends up having a perspective and a take on life that is really quite unique, and that most of his contemporaries and peers don't have. So most of the story is narrated by Zaki in the first person, but there are parts of the book that are in the third person, and that look at the lives of the women around him. So I will read a little bit from the second chapter, which is narrated by Zaki, young Zaki. So the grandmother's name is Dadi. Dadi is the grandmother, and Zaki's cousin is called Samar, and they have a maidservant, a cook in the house. Her name is Naseem. So this is Zaki talking about growing up in the house with Samarapi and with Dadi and his mother and the others. We had grown up together in the house. She was really my father's first cousin. Her mother, Choti, was Dadi's younger sister and lived with her husband in Barampur, a small village that she disliked and considered unsuitable for the raising of her only child. So, at the age of 2, Samarapi came to live with Dadi in Lahore. 2 years later, I was born, and though in moments of hostility she claimed to be my aunt, entitled by the nature of that position to deferential treatment, we were raised from the start to consider ourselves part of the same litter. We weren't alone. Suri and Hukmi, these are the boys' aunts, often went away in the afternoons and left their children with Dadi in the house. Asia and Maheen stayed inside the house, played with toys, and fought with each other. And Isa and Musa played squash against the wall of the veranda or played cricket on the lawn with the boys of the neighborhood. Occasionally, they allowed me to play with them. They made me wait in the driveway, then let me field the ball, or let me stand behind the wickets. And then they withdrew, sometimes citing my lack of skill as the cause, and sometimes nothing at all. It was made clear to me from the start that I was not one of them, since they had fathers, one each, whereas mine had left me for the skies. My father, Sami Shirazi, had been a flying officer in the Pakistan Air Force. I had never met him. He died when I was minus 2 months old. My mother was heavily pregnant when news of his death reached our house. He was flying a new kind of airplane above the Somiani Hills when a fault occurred in the control column, causing it to lock, and the plane spun out of control. I wasn't told the rest. It was withheld from me, for instance, that after taking the squadron leader's call, my mother had abandoned the telephone and had wandered out with a hand on her belly into the lawn where she had tried ambitiously to vomit. It was also withheld from me that the incident was quietly mourned. Accidents in the armed forces were not to be played up, and a fussy funeral was not observed. In any case, nothing had survived the crash. Nothing but a few resilient components from inside the aircraft that were then taken away for an inquiry. Dadi didn't take the news. She fumbled for her sleeping pills and took mental leave. Suri and Hukmi sat by her side and stroked her back, soothed her with words when she awoke, made her drink glasses of water, had her pace the room and encouraged her to go back to sleep. It went on like this until my mother walked in one afternoon with a baby in her arms, and Dadi sat up to receive the baby, reviewed its features, and saw that they were hers. Only 2 words came out of her quivering mouth. my grandson. Then she burst into howls. Suri and Hukmi began to stroke her back, and my mother recovered the baby from her arms and clasped it to her own chest, trying very hard not to cry. And so I came to learn that I had been given to Dadi as compensation for the death of her son. "Remember," she would say, pointing a forefinger to the ceiling, "with one hand Allah takes, and with the other He gives. You were given to us." She taught me to recognize my father in the pictures that stood on her mantelpiece. First, he was a boy of 6, posing with his cricket bat. His hair had been combed into 2 tidy flaps, and his scalp was a running stream. His face was guilty here. The eyes were frightened and staring. A bit of tongue was showing in his mouth. He had done something exciting and possibly adventurous that had later turned regrettable, and he was trying now to hide it. Suri and Hukmi were standing behind him. They were 10 and 7 respectively, wore matching white frocks, and stood with their fists clenched, their chins raised, their eyes aware of the photographer's presence and looking on mistrustfully. At 17, my father enrolled in the Air Force Academy and went away to live in Risalpur. He was a young man in this next photo, a cadet like the rest of his teammates, who had just participated in a hockey match. He wore a vest here and stood with his chest out. He had scored the last goal, and his side had won the match, and his heart was still beating from the exertion. The boy beside him was starting to smile. My father had cracked a joke, something about the cameraman, and his friend was trying now not to laugh. The other boys wore morose expressions to please the coach, who sat in the central chair in a tracksuit and was a middle-aged man with a dark, jowly, no-nonsense face, his hair dyed black and combed back, and his fists positioned demandingly on his knees. The names were listed under the picture on yellowing cardboard. Second row, left to right, standing. M. Khalil, B. Jabbar, S. Shirazi. But he outgrew the prankster and graduated from the academy and passed the various tests and conversion courses until he was posing for a picture with the first jet he was going to fly. He wore his G-suit here and was frowning in the sun, preparing himself for the flight, though he couldn't yet imagine the feeling. The new, unworn helmet was raised to his heart. "To my mother," said the picture at the bottom in a swift, looping hand. "With all my love, Sami." "Look," said Dadi, pointing to this picture on her mantelpiece. "Your father was such a dashing young man." My father was a dashing young man in Dadi's room. But in my mother's room he was someone else. A scattered man who lived in many things. The few books he had owned were kept separate from my mother's in the last drawer of her bedside table, which had once belonged to him. There were books on aviation, the Pilot's Encyclopedia of Aeronautical Knowledge, and episodes from the history of Pakistan Air Force, an insider's account, and also a book called Poems by Fares, in which there was Urdu as well as English writing. The pages of this last book were crisp and deliberately yellowed, and the writing was black and rich. Some of the pages even had folded corners. "He used to memorize the poems he liked," said my mother. "He would recite them to me sometimes." I told Dadi. She raised her chin and folded her hands in her lap and said, "I don't know about that. All I know is that he was a very serious young man." But there were pictures that my mother had of my father, and they testified to his whims. One morning he was stark and unshaven and went out to row a boat in a lake or a river. Only a stretch of water was visible behind him, and his hair was dirty and uncombed, his eyes almost shut against the glare. My mother said he looked like that because he had drunk alcohol at night. "Nonsense," said Dadi in her room. "Who tells you these things? He never touched it, not in his life. Others may have, but he didn't. He always refused it." I told my mother. She said, "It's wishful thinking." "Why does she do it?" I said. "Because she's his mother. She's had to keep him alive. People need things to believe in." My mother was lying in bed and trying to read her book. I said, "Even if the things aren't true?" She lowered the book and thought about what I had said. "Well," she said, "it's hard to say what's true sometimes. One person can have one way of looking at things, and another person might have another way. You can have your own beliefs as long as they allow other people to live their lives. You mustn't tell me that your beliefs are better than mine. I wouldn't like that, and neither would you if you put yourself in my position." But Dadi had said, "The truth is always there, whether you believe it or not." So I tried to believe in what remained of my father, and looked at his pictures and read his books. The Indian Army has responded vigorously to Pakistani infiltration of irregular forces into Kashmir. With the double pincer on Bhadauri Bulge, the Indians have captured the strategic Haji Pir Pass. Core areas in Azad Kashmir, including the towns of Muzaffarabad and Mirpur, are threatened. The only way out of this critical situation is to launch a diversionary maneuver. The shiny G-suit was hanging in the wardrobe and was ready for wearing. Operation Grand Slam is thus being launched in the early hours of 1st September 1965. Audacious as the plan is, it is taking the Indians by complete surprise. He was standing beside the jet, his helmet raised to his heart. He was going to fly it alone for the first time. A Pak army force consisting of an infantry division and two armed regiments, along with extensive artillery support, has started the attack on Indian positions. He was trying to move the control column, but it was stuck in his hands. Outnumbered and outgunned, Brigadier Manmohan Singh, Commander 191 Infantry Brigade, is faced with a critical situation. The plane was shuddering, and he is frantically calling for air support. But the plane went down, and he died all over again. "Good night," said my mother. She had finished reading her book. She returned it to the bedside table and reached out a hand to extinguish the lamp. But the thoughts stayed on in the dark and changed their shapes and became wishes that were then made silently to a dead father who was always somewhere, even after he had died, even after it was known that he would never respond. He was alive and he was listening. So this is just from... this is one bit about young Zaki getting one version of his father from his grandmother and then getting an often contradictory version of his father from his mother and imagining both into existence. This next bit is smaller. It's just from the same chapter. It's about now Samar Api, who's his cousin, who's growing up with him in the house. So Naseem is the cook, keep in mind, the maid servant. And this is about Samar and Zaki together as kids in Dadi's house. The one TV in the house was kept in Dadi's room. It had a bloated screen and stood on odd thin legs, which were capable of being dragged on their small whining wheels into the other rooms. To switch it on, we had to first connect the wires at the back, which Dadi had disconnected to prevent excessive electrical consumption. She believed in physical isolation, in full severance of physical contact between things. The TV was old and lacked a remote control and had to be approached for adjustments, for the color and the sound, even for the channel. In those days, there were only two channels, Doordarshan and PTV, and we called them India and Pakistan. "My India is not coming," Dadi cried in the evening. She had said her Maghrib prayers and then gone across the room to switch on the TV. And instead of the channels, she had found a grey gushing, which showed flashes of color when she changed the settings and caught snatches of music. But the settings had failed her and the grey gushing had gone on. "Oh, Naseem," she cried, "my India is not coming." And Naseem was sent in a hurry to adjust the aerial on the roof. We stood downstairs in the doorway and relayed messages from room to roof until the link was struck, color showed on the screen, and the position of the aerial had been found and was held. Then the Indian songs were watched, and the Indian news, and then the Pakistani news. And after the news came the televised songs of Madame Noor Jahan, who wore colourful saris and stood in shiny settings with her hands clasped at her waist and moved her mouth around to the words of her own songs, which Dadi said had been recorded many, many years ago in the studios where real, face-distorting expressions were allowed. Friday was then the weekly holiday in Pakistan. On Thursday night, we went in the car to Main Market, to a shop called Tomboy's Video Store that rented out pirated videos of Indian films. It was a small, damp shop. The walls were stacked with titles that began with Abhiman near the entrance, went around the room in a U, and culminated in Zanjeer on the opposite wall, a world that began and ended with Amitabh Bachchan, who was the male lead in both films and was said to be the most famous actor in the world. There was a story about this fame. It was about the time he was fighting the villain in Kuli and got punched by a real punch. It burst his intestine. He fell into a faint. An ambulance arrived. Its doors opened and closed. For days, the people of India had sat in temples and prayed, but the doctors in the hospital removed their glasses and shook their heads. The people continued to pray. They went into temples, struck bells and lit fires, sat on the floor and prayed with their eyes shut, their palms pressed together and their bodies swaying. One morning they opened their eyes and heard that Amitabh too had opened his. And then the news spread quickly and the temples emptied and there was singing and dancing in the streets. But Amitabh was ordinary, not fair or quick or clever like the other heroes of Indian films. He was a tall man, dark-skinned, with drooping bloodshot eyes, hairy on his arms and on his chest. the hair densely swirling behind his shirt buttons, which he opened one after the other in slow, deliberate movements when he committed to a fight. Even then his temperament was unaffected. He preferred to lean against walls in battles and fought with resisting thrusts of his long legs. Afterwards, wounded, he staggered out on these legs, but disguised the pain he was feeling with humor, which was dark and sour and tended to attract the shadows of tragedy. There was nothing remarkable about him. "Yes, there is," said Samarapi. "What is it?" "I won't tell you." She was lying in bed and writing inside a school notebook, turning her head from side to side. "Why?" I said. "Because you're a kid and you'll go and tell people." I was wounded. "Will you tell people?" "I already said I won't." "So say it again." "I won't tell people." "Say God promise." "God promise." But she went on writing in her notebook. "God promise." "Fine," she said, and came forward and whispered it in my ear. His V-O-I-C-E. She said she was madly in love with him. The picture frame on her bedside table was made of two small hearts that touched when they folded, uniting her with Amitabh. And the walls were swarming with posters and stills from his movies, including images from the very early years, which had been culled from cracking magazines that were bought in second-hand bookshops and continued to fill the darkness beneath her bed. Every month she returned from the market with fresh supplies of Stardust and Filmfare and Cine Blitz and Movie Magic and flung them lavishly on her bed. The magazines contained lively articles with titles like The Old and the Beautiful and used a recurring stock of terms to report on the Indian film industry. Of these words, Vixen and Half-Baked were Samarapi's favorites. "Oh, please," she would say to the mirror in the morning, "you're nothing but a half-baked vixen." On film nights, we extracted the VCR from Dadi's room and set it up with the TV in Samarapi's room. Our places were on the floor, before the TV, on cushions taken from beds and sofas. And the films were often familiar and contained songs and dances and dialogues we already knew by heart. But we watched them with a peculiar excitement, anticipating and also inhabiting the culminations, which we reenacted afterwards. I lay on the floor and held an empty 7-Up bottle in my hand and waved it about like an inebriated Amitabh. And she gasped with surprise and shrugged her shoulders like Parveen Babi in Namak Halal, then wrapped herself in a bedsheet and stood on the bed and began to weep, the lonely Jai Bahaduri of Abhiman, her hands repeatedly drawing the white veil across her forehead. She was suffering then, a woman in pain. She settled in a chair before the mirror and began to touch her face, her neck, recovering from her sadness. And then she was running down a staircase, and the lights in the ballroom were coming alive, and the guests were all turning now to look, and she was Jayaprada in Sharabi, her dress billowing in the wind, and she was arriving at last to end the long wait of the night. "Oh, mere sajna, main aa gayi." She danced and she danced, and she danced and she danced, until she fell to the floor in a tangle of exhausted limbs, sweating and out of breath. One day she pledged to the ceiling between breaths, "My Amitabh will come." "How do you know?" I said. "I know it." "You never know where life takes you," I said, because it was something my mother had told me. But she was adamant. "You'll see," she said, seeing it in the ceiling, in the stars beyond. "I'll find him." So this is it, I think. Thank you for listening. Thanks a lot. So, comments, questions, anything? Yes, hi.
There's actually a lot of questions I'd like to ask.
Sure.
I think the two I have in mind are, when you came to the United States to go to college, did you experience a lot of culture shock? And what did you think of the United States versus your life in Pakistan? And then my second question is, what has been the reaction of other Pakistanis and Pakistani-Americans that have read your novel?
Well, I can answer the second question first. The second question is, what has been the reaction of other Pakistanis or Pakistani-Americans who've read my book? This book has been published only a week, so it's too early to say what their reaction has been. But I can tell you a little story about that in a bit, which will demonstrate to you, I think, all the range of reactions that is possible, and that I'm anticipating and trying to prepare myself for. But the first question was, did I experience culture shock when I came to the U.S.? I didn't really, and you know, part of that was because I had been to the the US before. I had my parents are both journalists in Pakistan, and they've been in trouble often with the government. And my father was arrested when I was 1 month old for publishing a pro-democracy book under martial law. And then he was arrested in 1999 when I was 15 and my younger sister was 12 for making what was what they called an unpatriotic speech in enemy territory, which was he was at a conference in India and he said Pakistan is a failing state. It's, you know, no big secret now, but in 99, you know, you could be arrested for it and tried for treason. So, you know, the crucible. I was aware of... he had a heart attack when they arrested him because they broke into the house and they beat up my parents and they dragged him away at night. He had to come to the U.S. for treatment because there was not the treatment he needed was not available in Pakistan. So I was 15 that summer and we accompanied him and I lived in D.C. for a month. And I did an internship there while I was there. While he was recovering at home, I used to go in the morning and do... So I was already familiar with, you know, I guess going to, you know, getting up at 8 in the morning, being at work at 9 o'clock and then coming back at 6 o'clock, you know, and having a coffee break in between and these kinds of things and taking the subway to work and that sort of stuff. And when I went to college in Massachusetts, it wasn't very different from life in Washington, D.C. Now that I've been on this book tour, I've been to many more interesting places within the U.S. that I think if I'd gone to college there, I would have experienced much more of a culture shock. But then at the same time, I think coming from a place like Pakistan, other aspects of those places would have been more familiar. It's a complicated sort of thing. But I think part of the thing is that, you know, I did grow up, you know, in the mid-90s, we had the arrival of satellite TV in Pakistan. Certainly in, like I say, in the middle class or affluent neighborhoods, you know, professional, like my parents were journalists. And so if your parents were professionals and if you went to a school where you spoke English and you had that kind of education, you were likely to also insist that your parents got this thing called the dish antenna, which was so exciting and everybody had. And so we got the Wonder Years and we got Baywatch and we got all of that. That was the real culture shock, actually, living in Pakistan. And that much of that is here. You know, someone like Samar Api, who's growing up in the city, grows up watching all those things. Along with Bollywood comes, you know, Beverly Hills 90210. And you're living in Pakistan and you are subject to all these different kinds of circumstances ultimately. But you watch these things, these wish-making kind of programs and get exposed to these other cultures which give you these fantasies almost about where your life can go, you know, and they teach you to dream in different ways. When you watch Bollywood, you think, man, this is possible, you know. When you watch American TV, it teaches you something slightly different. And then when you watch Saudi Arabia-sponsored TV, it teaches you something else, you know. It says, you know, your identity is Islamic first of all. So we grew up with all of those things. And I know it sounds like a kind of mishmash, but it equips you to deal with other cultures much better when you grow up, because you always know that what one culture tells you is not the entire story. You know, that's one thing that I knew. So when I got to college in the U.S., I went to college in 2002, September 2002. That's a year after 9/11 had happened. And so there was a lot of interest in Pakistan, a lot of curiosity. There was some suspicion as well. My roommates weren't entirely, you know, they didn't know what to expect. I didn't know what to expect of them. So they'd been told that Muslims, when they prayed, used to use a lot of water in the bathroom. And so they were, you know, they were worried about the taps and things. But I said, I don't really say my prayers. And so, you know, all of these things were, they were more comical than shocking. So I don't think I really experienced that much of a culture shock. I think the culture shock, or the culture surprise, I should say, maybe, or the cultural learning that I ended up doing and I'm still doing is deeper in a way. I think it's about the assumptions that people have in societies about life and about what can be expected. And I think it's sad for me. I live in Pakistan right now. I decided to go back to Pakistan. Things are not good there right now. You know, there's a lot of violence in Pakistan. That doesn't mean that life doesn't go on. Life does go on. You know, people continue to live their lives in the most ordinary ways. A bomb will go off outside my parents' office, you know, and the next day they're back at work. Life doesn't come to a stop. People continue to go to the market and buy vegetables and fruits and, you know, argue with each other and fight and watch TV and you know, go to cricket stadiums to watch cricket matches, and they cheer when Pakistan wins, which it just did last week, you know. So there's dancing on the streets, and people then don't care if a bomb is going to go off, but people You know, even my friends who are artists, my friends, boys and girls who are doing theater, who are doing music, who are doing fashion. My neighbor she makes clothes. She is the first woman in her family, the first young woman in her family to want a career, and it's been surprising enough for her parents to allow that. But when she saw recently the flogging of that girl in the Swat Valley, that video that aired on the TV channels, she was so outraged and shocked and saddened that she felt she had to make a statement about it. So she went out on the street and protested, and there were 2,000 other people with her. And that's completely new in a place like Lahore, where, you know, protest culture has always existed. Much of what the story here is it's set in the 1990s, so it was the time of Benazir Bhutto, who was our prime minister. And one, you know, the third chapter here opens with a protest that I recall myself, which was taking place in Lahore on the street when Benazir Bhutto was first dismissed. And my mother took me to that protest, and because she was a supporter, and I remember that. So, you know, there are these things that I feel I have to explain a lot of the time, because people are surprised when they hear that these things have existed simultaneously with this other culture which exists in parts of Pakistan, where a woman can be flogged or whipped for just stepping out of a house. You know, on the one hand, you have a woman prime minister, which, you know, yet hasn't happened in so many other countries of the world. And then at the same level, you have people, you know, women being whipped for going into the marketplace. So those contradictions, I think, are more pronounced in a place like Pakistan. And they became sharper for me. I began to see them in a new way. I think I was accustomed to them when I was growing up, so I didn't question them so much. I think now, having spent 4 years in the U.S. at a college in the U.S. and 1 year working in New York, and then 3 years trying to make sense of Pakistan in a book, I've really started to see it in a new way. So my culture shock is in the other direction. Yes.
So it sounds like your novel you've set up a tension between Dadi, who says the truth is there, and you have to, you know, whether you recognize it or not, and then on the other hand, your mother, the mother saying the truth is, you know, your truths are fine as long as they don't impact. Is that a tension that operates in the book?
Absolutely, that's a tension. That's the central tension in a way. I'd like to call it the metaphysical tension. Makes me sound pretentious, but it's true in a way. It's the dilemma of every life, isn't it? Like people who believe, you need faith, whether it's religious faith or political faith or faith in your ideals, whatever they are. Faith is a good thing, you know. You can't really do anything without faith. If you don't believe in what you do, if you don't believe in either God or your job or your family or your purpose or your path or whatever it is, you end up succumbing to other people's programs about how life should be lived. I'm arriving at that conclusion right now, I feel personally. If you don't carve out some lines for yourself and paths for yourself, you end up walking the paths other people have already created. There's no such thing as free-floating in life. But then at the same time, you have to constantly question and examine the path every step you take. So actually, it's not a straight path in the end. After you've walked it, it's like this, and then it's like this, and then it's like that, and then it's like that. But you have to begin every time by saying, okay, from here to here. You know?
But it's as if that's the central tension in Islam ideology.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. The central tension in Islamic ideology. Well, again, you know, there's a. I don't know how much you know about the history of Pakistan or South Asia and Islam in South Asia, but Islam arrived in South Asia through Sufis, who were these mystic wanderers and poets and dancers and singers who brought the message of Islam, which was of an egalitarian society and of a caste-free society, which was an idea that kind of took off in some parts of North India and South India at that time, and I'm talking about as early as like the 8th, 9th centuries. The Lahore is actually my home city because it's the capital of North India, and because these people were coming from Central Asia and from Afghanistan and Iran, what is today Iran. Lahore is home to some of the oldest Sufi shrines in whole of the Indian subcontinent. So the oldest mausoleum in Lahore, a Sufi mausoleum in Lahore, is 1,000 years old. And it's the central mausoleum in Lahore. And there are 1 million people there every Thursday, men and women who circulate. And it's a kind of self-governing kind of system. The dead saints, people, you come to ask for something. You come with a wish. You come to make a wish. of some sort. And then you promise the saint that if your wish is granted, you will feed the poor at the shrine. And so a lot of poor people just, a lot of homeless people live inside the shrine. And whenever a government, new government is elected, it tends to expand the area of the shrine as a kind of gesture of public participation or public support. So it's an ancient kind of really old system, which doesn't really reflect how parliament works in Pakistan, let's say, or how the military works in Pakistan. These are more modern institutions. But it's a more entrenched system, and the belief systems that encourages this idea that religion and Islam especially is about the individual's quest for God, so much of Sufi poetry, in fact the bulk of Sufi poetry that was produced in and around Pakistan, and that people still recite and sing in songs. Madam Noorjahan, the singer who I just described here, used to appear every night on the TV news after the news, who sang and from the age of 10 until like she died at the age of 80, used to sing a lot of these very famous Sufi poems because they were meant to be put to music. The Sufis themselves composed them in the local languages of the people that they encountered when they came to these places, and then put them to music. And so in a mostly illiterate society where people who don't get to go to school can't read books, it's a great way of overcoming that barrier. People just hear things on the radio and they know them by heart. So it's like, you know, most of our great classical singers have sung the poetry of our poets. And it's sort of like Nina Simone singing Shakespeare or something. It really would be like that, you know, the great old institutions, the men and women who are supposed to be the greatest vocalists, who are supposed to be the greatest practitioners of their craft, singing poets from the 16th century all the way to the present. And so a lot of Pakistan's political history, our poets who were our leftist poets in the 60s and 70s, the poets of the Sufi poets who wrote often about very subversive poems about sexual longing and love and, you know, doing away with the establishment and even about same-sex love, actually. A lot of these things that are not a part of the institutional structure of Pakistani society that governments always discourage and put down because they want to make society more Islamic so that we can be separate from India, which is Hindu. You know, this is what the Pakistan military has been trying to do for 60 years now. Can't really penetrate society to that level, you know, which is the level of almost the languages we speak. These wisdoms, what you're talking about, this is contained within our culture. I went to Saudi Arabia recently and I was just so amazed by how alien it was to where I came from. When I went to India, it seemed much more familiar. It seemed much more like Pakistan. So I think that is a central tension. There's the tension, there's the fundamentalist Wahhabi kind of, you know, there's this one way of doing it, and we will tell you how to do it from this other country, you know, in the Middle East. And then there's the opposing impulse, which is, you know, homegrown and everybody knows, but nobody's had the chance to really encounter it in newspapers or in textbooks in schools or in things. So they don't think of it as their official history, but it's the unofficial history.
Thank you.
Sure. Book signing? Would anybody like to buy the book?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So thank you all for coming. Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. Thank you. Thanks for being here.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 Tattered Cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.